All right, Baby Friday on the Fan pregame rolls on. Justin Cuthbert and Jesse Rubinoff. We are full steam ahead. Paris 2024 is within our grasp. You're heading there, what, this weekend?
Sunday, yeah.
Getting ready to go? Yeah. Are you packed? Are you prepared in any discernible way?
What day is today? Thursday?
Thursday.
It's Baby Friday. I haven't even started, no. Is that like a...
But you'll be
would
ready.
You have started by now?
Nah, there's not a chance.
Who does that?
Takes me 10.
Nobody does that. We'll have to ask Mark Lee if he does.
Yeah, let's ask Mark Lee. He's called 16 Olympics, so he's done this before. And those Olympics include Andre DeGrasse's and Damian Warner's gold medals in Tokyo. And that was different Olympics there in Tokyo. Mark Lee joins us now. Mark, thanks for jumping on.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
So this is truly a return to normalcy for the Olympics, right? I mean, you were there in Tokyo. I was watching some highlights today. No one in the seats, an empty stadium for the 100 meter, which is, of course, you know, one of the main events of the Olympic Games. How refreshing will it be to be calling big races, big competitions in jam-packed stadiums?
Oh, it's going to be like night and day. I mean, it was so strange in Tokyo to be inside that 80,000 seat stadium, and there wasn't a single fan there. I mean, the athletes were amazing. The performances were outstanding without having any kind of feedback. But as a play-by-play announcer, you really feel the crowd when you're calling events, and it gives you that rush, that tingle, you know, before the gun goes off. So it was kind of weird, to be honest. We had to wear masks everywhere we went and then took them off just as we got into the commentator's box. I remember the strangest part of the Tokyo Games were the strict rules that they had in place. We were all double vaxxed. Most of the population of Tokyo had yet to be vaccinated, but they were really concerned about us. So every day when we went back to the hotel between the morning and the evening sessions, we were allowed 15 minutes to walk to a 7-Eleven to get basically these little cellophane wrapped sandwiches like tuna in seaweed, that kind of thing, and then get back to the hotel. And we had to check out with a security guard, sign the time of our departure, and then sign back in. And if you weren't back within 15 minutes, they kind of went looking for you, and they threatened that they would pull your accreditation. So the circumstances, the conditions under which we worked were trying, to say the least, but the athletic performances saved the day for all of us.
Yeah, so I guess you're looking forward to this time when it could be a little more normal.
Be a free-for-all for both of you.
So you've done 16 Olympics in your time. Like, I'm just curious, on a professional level, like, obviously you're familiar with a lot of the Canadian athletes, but you do so many different events. Like, when does the preparation start for you? I know the Olympics come around, you know, every 2 years, you know, every 4 years if you're only doing the summer or winter games exclusively. But when does it start? Like, when does the research and homework start for you?
Well, in this case, for track and field, I'm usually starting intensely preparing for 3 months out.
Wow.
And right now, I mean, if you look at my office, it's full of binders and papers everywhere. It's a real paper chase. there's 48 events in track and field. So there's just so many people involved. And every week there's a race or a competition somewhere. And so the numbers keep changing. So the preparation is huge. You know, between Olympics in that quadrennial period, you'd have world championships and other major competitions to, you know, keep your head in the game.
Right.
But it's a real it's very demanding. It you know, you don't feel good, you don't feel confident going somewhere like the Olympics unless you're prepared. So that's the proof. You've got to spend the time in advance.
Mark, we've been talking about the pressure of the moment that the Olympic provides all week, and you have an interesting, I mean, you do a lot of events, clearly, but the main event is going to be the men's 100 meter. I feel like that is, you know, the crown jewel of track and athletics, and of course, you're going to be on that call, and you talk about 3 months of preparation, and this is going to be something that lasts under 10 seconds, hopefully. Like, what... You know, if you're calling a hockey game, you got 3 hours to put your stamp on it. You have to put your stamp on it in 10 seconds. Do you think about that? Is it natural to you? Is it part of your process where you're thinking about that, or are you just prepare yourself and you let it fly?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's the shortest race and it's the hardest to do. And it's the buildup. It's these 3 months of watching who's doing what, who's running fast. And then going through the rounds of the games from the first round to the semifinals to the final, that's where you start to get a feel of who's peaking, who's running fast. And then come the final, it's excruciating because, I mean, you're tingling. The crowd is buzzing. You set the lanes. And then you put your eyes on three, maybe four athletes. You really have to do that. And then use your peripheral vision to see if somebody comes out of the woodwork, especially, you know, in lanes, say, eight or nine or down in one or two. They're the hardest lanes to follow. But, you know, it's the most amazing experience I've ever had in sports television because I remember the first time at the Bird's Nest in Beijing, it was like 80, 90,000 spectators there. They set the lanes and then on your marks and the place goes quiet and you can hear a pin drop and then set. And then the gun goes off and there's this explosion of energy. The athletes come out of the blocks. The crowd goes crazy. There's flashbulbs everywhere in the stadium. And you kind of feel as the announcer, you're on this like wave and you're riding this 10-second wave to the finish line. And it happens so quickly. It's amazing how, you know, you think about that race. When I'm calling it, time seems to slow down because you're watching so many things and you're trying to pick up the leader, pick up, you know, who's second, third. And it's mind-boggling and your focus is so intense, but it's like a crescendo that builds and then there's this explosion of elation for the athletes.
You've done so many, you've called so many incredible moments throughout Olympic history and Canadian Olympic history, whether it's Andre DeGrasse or Damian Warner, you know, Usain Bolt, years ago, like of all of those memories that you have and all of those calls that you've made, do you have one that particularly sticks out in your mind as being, you know, the one above all, maybe not just your own, you know, personal call, but a moment that you were a part of?
Yeah, I mean, those three are right up there. I'd say my first experience back in 2008 with Bolt breaking the world record in both the 100 and the 200 in Beijing, that stands out because that was my first Olympics calling track and field. The legendary Don Whitman had just passed away about 6 months before those games. And so I got the call to be ready. And I'll tell you guys this story behind the scenes. I remember the night before the men's final, we were in the Bird's Nest and they asked me to step away from my chair and they put my headset over the back of the chair and they locked off this shot. And I thought, that's interesting. And what they were doing was they were doing a feature on Don Whitman and they basically had his headset hanging on an empty chair. And so just before we went to air with the 100 meter final, they rolled this 10-minute beautiful documentary on Don. And it was so emotional to watch. And then they came to me on camera and I thought, you know, wow, this is the hardest act to follow. And I just watched this incredible broadcaster's life story being told. And now I got to step up and call my first 100 meter final in the Olympic Games. So needless to say, that was massive pressure. But all I could do was just think about the task at hand and kind of like let everything roll off my shoulders. So that stands out. But of course, the DeGrasse gold in the 200 was thrilling because it's not often you get to call a Canadian winning an Olympic gold medal in track and field. And then Damian Warner's, you know, 9,000 point gold in the decathlon was another spectacular event to cover. So they're all up there. They're all, you know, they all rank among the best, but it's often that first challenge you face that you always remember.
Usain Bolt will be, you know, incredibly. Probably if you're reflecting on your career, I'm sure an image of Usain Bolt is going to be one of the first that pops up. But this is now a Boltless world and has been. So who is the main protagonist now for track and the athletics for Paris 2024? Who is the main character of the events that you will oversee?
Well, that's a great question because the circumstances have changed dramatically in the last month. But I would say Noah Lyles will tell you he's the heir apparent. He wants to be the heir apparent. Mm-hmm. He's the great showman, you know, of these games. He's kind of one of those sprinters who grew up watching Bolt. And now, you know, Bolt changed the face of sprinting. It used to be, you know, a testosterone-fueled, you know, grudge match with guys staring each other down and pawing at the turf. Bolt came along and had fun. And so Lyles is sort of the next generation in that group. He's a showman. He's a flamboyant dresser. He's got unshakable confidence, and he backs it up. Mm-hmm. So he's the two-time world champion at the 100 and 200 going in. But in the last few weeks, this kid named Kishane Thompson has come out of nowhere in Jamaica and run a 9.77. It's the fastest time in the world this year. We haven't seen him since. He ran the Jamaican trials, ran a 9.82, a 9.84 or 5, and then a 9.77. And people are saying, who is this kid? He looks like Asafa Powell. He's big and powerful, has a great start. And then he tells the world after he runs a 9.77 to win the Jamaican trials that his coach told him to shut it down at 60 meters. And he was gliding. And you can look, if you look at the tape, he's looking left and right at 70.
That's so good.
Now what, right? And then you got Andre DeGrasse, who's this championship performer. He's 6 for 6 in the Olympic finals, right? Getting a medal. But he hasn't broken 10 seconds this year. There are 31 men in the world who run faster in the 100. He's just dipped under 20 seconds in the 200. But his circuitry, the way he's wired, he comes to the Olympic Games, he comes to global championships and shines. And the director of high performance was telling me for Athletics Canada last week that he actually thrives through the rounds. The rounds are what, you know, can take a toll on athletes who are very fast in one-off races around the world, but they've got to run three times, right, including the final. And that sometimes takes a toll, whereas DeGrasse seems to just peak and rise through these rounds. And he has this nose for the finish line. He has this competitive spirit. So I never write him off, even though his numbers say that he's not in the same league as some of these other guys.
You mentioned DeGrasse, and we talked about Damian Warner a little bit earlier. What are the chances Warner can repeat? Because, you know, I'm 35. I get out of bed and something goes wrong every day, wrist, back, whatever it is. He's 34 and obviously much different athletically than I am. But I would imagine being 34 and trying to win that event is probably much different than it would be at 30 years of age. So are the expectations still as high for Damian Warner as they've been in the past?
Well, that's a good point. He's 34. And like he's in the sunset of his decathlon career. But, you know, something funny happened before Tokyo. Remember during the whole COVID pandemic, he was forced to train inside, I think it was the Thompson Arena in London, Ontario.
Yeah. Western University.
Right?
Yeah.
He had a 40 meter track. He had to throw into a net, couldn't pole vault. And then he comes out and he scores 9,017 points, sets an Olympic record, wins the gold. And so researchers and sports scientists around the world are going, what just happened here? And as he stumbled onto something that we never thought about, and that would be less is more. And so in this next quadrennial, he's actually doing less in terms of impact training, you know, jumping. He's not subjecting his body to as vigorous a training he would have done a decade ago when he was on the rise and he was trying to perfect his skills. Now he's figured out the pole vault, the javelin, you know, the technical events. He is the world's fastest decathlete at the 100, the 110 hurdles. I mean, he's world class in those events. And so it's all about getting that body through 10 events over 2 days. And, you know, he just won the Gutsus Hypobank meeting in May. Before there was ever a world championship, that Gutsus decathlon in a small town in Austria was the unofficial world championship. It was the place where Daley Thompson broke world records. It was a place they all felt comfortable competing in. And so he's won it a record 8 times in a row, won it again this year. And so I wouldn't write him off. He knows how to navigate the Olympics. He's going to face a huge challenge in Leo Neugebauer, who's this 6'7" beast, who's gone over 8,900 points this year. He's won back-to-back NCAA titles for Texas. He broke Jürgen Hingson's 37-year-old German record last year, bettered this year. When Hingson held that German record, it was a world record. So this kid is an absolute animal. He keeps getting faster and better. Thing is, the last two events in the decathlon, the javelin and the 1500 meters, are his worst. So just at the end of a two-day competition where your body's beginning to gas, he's going to be faced with two of his most difficult events. And that's where Damian seems to thrive. And so that's going to make it really interesting. The real sad news is that Pierce Lepage, world champion, is not going to be able to go. He suffered a herniated disc in his back back in winter training. Tried to come back. He ran a 400 in Guelph in June and was 5 seconds off his PB. And he got an exemption at the Canadian trials, but it just wasn't meant to be. He can't come back. So, you know, we're going to miss our 1-2 punch in decathlon, but Damian will be full value, I'm sure.
We're chatting with Mark Lee, who will be covering track and athletics at the Paris Summer Games. Track and athletics will be the first sport or collection of sports to introduce prize money this year. Prize money now for, in addition to a gold medal for those who own the stage in Paris. How much does prize money matter, if at all, Mark?
Well, I mean, it's what, $50,000 for a gold. That's recognizing the athletes are part of the show and that they deserve something. But I think most of these athletes could care less about money when it comes to the Olympics. It's all about the medals. And to be honest, so many of the world's top runners, sprinters, have not run that much this year to get, you know, fees, appearance fees at major international meets because they're deciding to stay home and train for the gold medal. So that tells you that they've got their shoe contracts and all their endorsement deals, the big ones. But what's most important is that medal, not the money. But I think it's a nod to the athletes that, let's face it, the Olympics makes billions of dollars off these kids, and you know, they're giving them something back.
What do you like most about the Olympics outside of actually being inside the stadium and calling it? Like, is it exploring? Do you get to explore the cities when you're there? Like, what kind of offbeat thing is there that you enjoy about
7-Eleven sandwiches?
So much? Yeah, 7-Eleven seaweed wrap sandwiches. What is it?
So those seaweed wraps were a highlight for sure. No, I'll tell you what, I mean, we don't have any time to ourselves. Mm-hmm. We do, it's 10 straight days, two sessions a day. So we're making 40 trips to and from the stadium over 10 days.
Wow.
It's usually really hot. I remember in Tokyo, it was 34 degrees at 10 a.m. and humid.
Yikes.
So the conditions are hot. You've got to stay hydrated. So basically, it's you know, you leave at 7 a.m. for the morning session. You might get back to your hotel around 1:30. You have about 3 hours to prep the evening session, which involves, you know, semifinals and finals. Maybe catch a 30-minute nap, and then you're back again, and you get back to your hotel at, say, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, and then you're up again by 5:36. So it's pretty grueling. What's really fun about it is the guys I get to work with. Michael Smith, a three-time Olympian in decathlon, former silver medalist in the world championship, and David Moorcroft, who was a world record holder at one time in the 5,000 meters and was the head of UK athletics. They're both brilliant people to work with. There's great camaraderie, and that's what that's basically what we have when we're not on the air. Is you have this camaraderie. We don't see anything except the drive to and from the stadium, unfortunately. But you know what? There's just so much going on when it comes to the work that's so exciting that fills our plate every day.
Last one for you, Mark. Give us the name of a Canadian Olympian who you will call their events that we must watch, that we need to tune in for. We obviously know about, you know, Andre DeGrasse and some of the bigger names, but someone that might be flying under the radar that should have our attention in Paris.
Okay. Well, can I give you two parts of that? I'll give you
of course
athletes that I'm going to call that I think are almost locks for gold medals.
Okay.
And those are our hand throwers. Ethan Katzberg, 6'6" kid from BC, looks like, you know, Burton Cummings of the Guess Who. He won the world championship last year, and this year his best throw, which is the new Canadian record, is 3 meters farther than anybody else. You think about his event. It's a 16-pound steel ball on the end of like a piano wire. Think about taking the biggest, heaviest ball at a bowling alley, putting a piano wire around it, swinging it and throwing it over a 4-story building, because that's the height you got to get at the apex, and have it land in the length of a football field. That's what this kid's doing. And he's 22, and he is just a natural. He apparently has the fastest swing velocity in the world right now. So that 16-pound ball is coming out of his hands at 120 kilometers an hour. Think about that. That's incredible physics. And then Cameron Rogers, who also won the world championship in the women's hammer throw, she right now is leading the world on the athletes who are in Paris. Brooke Anderson, who had the best throw in the world this year, fouled out of the U.S. trials. Like, that's the thing about this sport. You've got to not only throw it far, but you got to throw it straight. She threw her 3 qualifiers out of the sector onto the track and didn't get a mark, and so she's not even going. And there's Sarah Mitten, who's leading the world right now with a new Canadian record in the shot put. So it's the golden age of throws for Canada.
Okay.
But the one person that people may not have heard about is this Christopher Morales Williams from Vaughan. And he runs the 400 meters. He's 19 years old, and he's competing right now for the University of Georgia. And you guys may have heard this story, but he broke the world indoor record earlier this year, but they wouldn't give it to him because they said the timing blocks weren't calibrated or weren't official to World Athletics standards, but he still has the world best. Then he went outdoors and he had the fastest time in the world this year, a 44.05 clocking, which smashed the old Canadian record held by Tyler Christopher. And up until last week, it was the fastest in the world. It was just bettered last week in Paris by Quincy Hall of the United States. So this is a 19-year-old kid who just turned pro like a week ago, got a deal with Adidas. He's going to stay in school. He can't run NCAA anymore because he's a pro. Mm-hmm. But he's studying animals, ecology or something. And he wants to finish his degree. This is the kid to watch because he was discovered by Tony Sharp. Remember him? He was a sprinter back in the Ben Johnson era. He coaches now. He's the guy that discovered Andre DeGrasse. Mm-hmm. Now he's discovered Christopher Morales Williams. And he said, the one thing about this kid that is really unusual is he seems unaffected by lactic acid. He said he takes off at 200 meters and where other athletes' muscles are shortening and screaming, he seems to be able to withstand that. So he had a rough race a week ago. He finished in, I think, 5th place in Paris, but he was like more than a second off his best times. And that was his first race as a pro. And I guarantee you, that was a good experience for him because he was looking at the big stage, looking at the big boys, and it wasn't university anymore. And he has a contract with a major, shoe supplier. And so glad he had that experience. Let's see what happens come Paris. But he's the kid to watch.
Okay, I have a suggestion to make the Olympics even better than it already is, and I need a big name like yourself to get on board, because you were talking about the hammer throw and how they throw it like 120 miles an hour, kilometers an hour. Like, just put an average person in each event, and it will illustrate just how incredible these athletes are. Because when they're going up against each other, it's like, well, yeah, but you need some sort of context. So I think we need to start a movement to get just an average.
Isn't that why you're going to Paris?
An average, the hammer throw. Get an average Joe or average Jane in every single event, and as long as you're on board with me, I think we can do something with it.
I love that. I saw Snoop Dogg running the 200 at the U.S. trials.
Yeah.
He didn't look very fast.
Yeah, right? No, you might have to pan out the camera a little bit just to make sure that you get the person, the average person. No, just trailing behind.
There is drug testing at the Olympics.
I remember being asked to go into a media race at U of T during one of the Canadian championships, and Michael Smith said to me, "Whatever you do, don't do it. Your own can look really bad."
Yeah, no doubt.
There you go. We are so close to the Olympics. It's going to be awesome. Mark Lee is going to be on the call for track and athletics, and it's going to be rich with Canadian heritage moments. I can't wait, Mark. Safe travels, and we'll be hearing your call soon.
Justin, Jesse, thanks for having me on. Justin, say hi to your dad.
Will do. That's Mark Lee of CBC. Boy, to not be affected by lactic acid.
Yeah, I was going to throw it. It must be nice.
That must be. That must be pretty good. That must be pretty good.
But, like, how is that possible? I love that.
Can you imagine? Right now by lactic acid. Okay, we got to hit a break because still to come, we have Mike Fiuta. One very quickly, though. The $50,000,
Whatever.
I've always tried to think about, like, what the value of a gold medal would be. And it's not 50,000. It's more. Like, yeah. you're made. You're a made man, depending on your country, especially made man, made woman. If you win a gold medal and take one home, I mean, there are stories like that in Canada, you know, through decades and decades of people who have, you know, built careers and had so much success after winning a gold medal. But $50,000 added on is pretty good.
Let me ask you this. I was going to say it was a... It's a bit of a slippery slope. Like, where does it end? Like, it starts at 50,000.
That's the problem.
What if it's like $1 million to win 100 meters?
But, like, NIL was supposed to be this, like, great thing, right? Like, yeah, give them a little bit of money. Now it's just completely,
it's
like, it is threatening college sports at a deep level.
Right. So I
don't think it'll be the same.
Does it really matter if, you know, the 100 meters gives away $1 million for a gold medal? Like, how does that change things? Is there someone out there that's not...
A million might change.
That's not running. But is there someone out there that's not running the 100-meter dash because... there's no prize money, like that. Thanks to the fastest person in the world, like I don't know, it's Tyreek Hill, the fastest guy on earth, and we just don't know because he makes more money in the NFL.
I doubt it. That's the point. Like the 50, like it's not enough to change the way it operates because you're gonna get that money if you.
Yeah, I'm not sure there's a number out there even.
I'm scared with the NIL stuff. Yeah. Anyway, we'll hit a break. Mike Fiuta next. We're gonna go through all 7 Canadian teams, where they're at, where they're going. Who won the offseason, who's not doing much in the offseason. We'll break it all down, a little NHL discussion next on the Fan Pregame.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, back on the Fan Pregame. Been discussing the Raptors win total for a lot of the show, 30.5.
Yeah.
That's the projection in Vegas.
Yeah.
6 years ago today, one of the most impactful trades ever in Raptors history, acquiring Kawhi Leonard. 6 years ago today.
That's gross.
And now we're at 30.5 projections.
That is so gross. How is that 6 years ago? What is going on?
Anything that blurs the lines, pandemic, like anything that happened there, it just like completely like distorted history and everything.
It's like it didn't happen.
Maybe we're just getting old and we like to blame it on
that. I think that happens. I think as you get older, time goes by quicker, which is sad.
Let's bring in someone young in heart.
Yeah.
Mike Fiuta.
Love that.
Former Canes consultant, former Kings assistant GM.
He likes it too.
Does a lot of work with Heroes and Sports Net. What's going on, Mike?
Is that hard?
What's that? Young at heart. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't look young the other night when I was watching Teoscar Hernandez win the home run derby while Jeremy Swanson was having wings in Buffalo.
So good.
Yeah, it's pretty rough.
Great to see you, Jesse.
Are you a Mike, are you an Olympics guy? We just had Mark Leon and we were talking about some of the Canadians that have a great shot at medals. Like if you could do one event. Because I made the suggestion to Mark that the only way to make the Olympics better than it already is just have some rando in every event. Just some person off the street. So you get an idea, the context that, you know, these guys are truly amazing. Like what, if you could be in one event on the Olympic stage, what would it be? Would it be like field hockey? Because you have a long history in hockey. Yeah.
As I'm young and hurt, I'd have to go with breakdancing right out of the gate. You've never seen me at a wedding, at least with a couple in me. Is this worth throwing against the wind? I mean, an Olympics person, I'm an everything Canadian person, so I absolutely love it. I mean, I full national, get out the flag and just cheer like crazy in every sport, the track and just everything. I love it. It's just a great moment. I mean, I've met some Olympians and stuff and some people that I, you know, that through the hockey, I mean, obviously the hockey we follow, but even now with the golf and stuff like that. I just love it. Yeah, I've been following, I watch this show religiously. So I know with it being a bit of a down for the big sports, not the professional sports right now, being a little quiet, that you guys have been doing a lot more Olympic stuff. So it's just, it's amazing. Like even to think about like before, like, first of all, obviously, you know, during my youth when Ben Johnson scandal and all those different things. It's just so nice to see that we're kind of back in the world stage and how successful we are. And I mean, even like, I guess the decathlon guy, there's just so many different sports that are up for doing well, and it's going to be amazing. And I mean, come off of, like, I know I've followed even the way you talked about, because I'm not a huge soccer fan, but I'm again with Canada to be able to now watch soccer and at that level. It's so cool, other than just hockey, which obviously I've got no issue with, but getting outside that realm, it's just absolutely amazing. Even seeing the Major League Baseball All-Stars that Canadian are representing now. So it's pretty cool. Yeah.
It really does elevate everything. The Olympic rings bring new meaning to things. And when you're wearing, when you're wearing the Maple Leaf for Canada, I mean, you work with guys who did represent Canada on the biggest stage, hockey. Like, what did it mean to Drew Doughty to wear the Olympic flag to play and represent Team Canada at the Olympics?
And it's a great, he won two, right? So, And he won the first one really young, and he was kind of like more the 70 that played his way in to where he was a top pairing guy. And now he's, young at heart, but he's dying to not, he was absolutely follows and is livid when he sees rosters that he's not on this year's or the upcoming Olympic roster. So it clearly means the world to them. I know when they talk about their internally, when they talk about that elite club of guys that have won the cup, won the world juniors, won the world championships and won Olympic medal, they have that internal pride. It's off the charts when they talk about it. So clearly anytime these guys get to pull a jersey on, but again, I think the biggest adjustment is when they have their humorous behind the scenes talks is obviously these guys are used to Ritz-Carlton's and the Olympic lounges are a little different than some of their lifestyles, but I think it probably makes it that much more special for them in the long run.
Yeah, indeed. And we're on a good run here, as you mentioned, soccer, Olympics, Canadian men's national team defending gold, and we're going to get some hockey soon. It's all gravy at the moment. Okay, so let's talk about the seven Canadian teams since you're all about waving that Canadian flag. In the NHL right now, a bit of a temperature check in the middle of summer as we gear toward this upcoming season. Let's go alphabetical. It means we're starting with the Calgary Flames. They were kind of not really players in free agency. They're going towards that rebuild. So we're doing where they're at and where they're going. Where are they at now in their efforts to bottom out a little bit, retool, revamp with a new GM in Craig Conroy? And where do you expect them? Where are they going this year? Like, what is this year going to look like for the Calgary Flames?
It's a tough one because I agree with you that this is, if there's ever a group that needs a rebuild, and I think it might scare some of their fan base because new arena talks and stuff like that. But you take out, was it Zadorov, Mangiapane, Lindholm, Markstrom, Hanifin, you're rebuilding. I mean, and I think it gets back to, and the problem is they don't have a lot coming through their systems, which is going to take time to draft. I mean, I don't know they could have had an amazing draft this past, and I hope they did for the good of the group. But there's a big gap between the huge contracts they signed, like Huberdeau, Uyghur, and Naz, and the gap between their young guys that are ready to play, which really aren't. And some of the holes there, it's a tough one to look at. So I think they're a team that's taking steps back, and I think they're really going to have to redress a full rebuild as opposed to a retool.
Well, let's go to a team that's actually in the midst of a rebuild, the Montreal Canadiens. And Mike, it's like a slow burning rebuild that, you know, they better nail it or they're going to be in for some lean years for a while, because it's not like they're attracting top names to come and play with that core. I guess the question is, like, is that core good enough to take them eventually to where they want to go?
Surprisingly quiet for me. Like, I thought that was a team that was, you know, obviously they played a lot better under St. Pierre. I find them to be incredibly, they seem to be small. I mean, obviously up front with Cole Caulfield and stuff like that. They, I mean, they signed the big Slavkovsky. I got a big deal out of the thing, and they drafted a Russian. I guess they're pretty high on, but I thought again, it was like almost Blue Jay, like in a sense that I was expecting so much more in the, and there's still time, but like that free agent rumbling, I just felt they were going to be way more involved in trying to make this current group a little bit better, because I mean, again, the East is you know, fairly wide open. I mean, there's some teams you got to look at what's coming, right? I know we're going to talk about Ottawa, but when you look at the divisions and you think that, like, I think New Jersey's had an exceptional, I know they're not Canadian, but you've just got to look at the teams around you that are improving. And maybe fortunately for Montreal, Buffalo seems to be in a stationary bike race as well. So hopefully their draft picks are coming up stronger. I mean, they've got some toughness on the back end, but I mean, there's a lot lacking with regards to star power and depth. And I just felt they'd be making more steps with bringing people in the organization than they have this offseason.
You and I have always been on the same wavelength, and I do the exact same thing. Anytime a team doesn't do enough, I just say they're like the Blue Jays. This happens every single time. So now you look at the Flames, look at the Habs, they haven't done anything. You just called them the Blue Jays. Like that. I know you're passionate about the Jays. It's like just so disappointing.
You guys are telling about Kawhi there. At least they didn't track any superstars coming on an airplane in the offseason to land in Montreal. Well,
but will they soon do that? Like, I look at Montreal, I'm like, that's not looking at the team, not looking at, you know, coach, general manager, whatever. Just Montreal, the Montreal Canadiens. To me, that is one of hockey's best destinations.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm racking my head for the last really big free agents they signed, the big splashy move that the Canadiens have made. I think they can do that. Maybe they're readying themselves to do that. Obviously, more money with the salary cap awaits, and they've got a young core they need to support. Are they still seen like that? Are they a destination?
Well, I believe they are. And yeah? I think it's a different market too. And maybe I'm off, but I mean, like, for example, Tyler Toffoli, who I'm very close with, he went there and it was almost like, it's like visiting a church still. Like he says, that the way they treat you, the historic nature of it is off the charts. And it's certainly when, I mean, and he's bounced around. I was bothering him. You should have him on as a guest because I think he's played for every Canadian team in the last 5 years. But he literally just talks about it with reverence. So I think it's there, but I also think it's a fan base that's very knowledgeable. And I don't think they're going to put up much longer without some of those big things. Like you can only hang your head on, and I love Suzuki, but that's not, when you talk about the elite players as you go across just the country, when we're talking, whether it's what's going on in Edmonton or Vancouver, there's not that elite. There's some very good players and very good pieces, but that elite piece is lacking and they just don't fall off the tree. So it'll be interesting. There's got to be some work done there, and they'll only be patient for so long.
Less of a Vatican vibe in Ottawa. The Ottawa Senators, though, have been busier than the Montreal Canadiens, rather. Steve Staios making some moves, some ups, some downs, shoring up the goaltending position, hopefully, although they believe they've done that before. What do you make of what Ottawa did the first year with Steve Staios here?
And I'm a huge Staios fan. I think when you look back, and I'm not a big analytics guy, but if you just want to do plus and minus, I think it was so obvious their goaltending let them down last year. And again, self-inflicted. It wasn't Stevie's guy they brought in, but they made the wrong decision to pay somebody too much who wasn't ready to carry the load. And I think Allmark, it'll be interesting now. I mean, obviously he's an all-star and playing for the Boston Bruins team in front of him is going to be a little different, but I love the direction they're going. I think there are some, you know, you've got the Brady Tkachuks and you've got the, you know, you've got some pieces there. I think Pinto being healthy and signed is going to help. I love the Jansen move, bringing him in on the right side. I'd still like to see another veteran presence on the back end. And you've got to keep Norris healthy. I think I love the coaching move. I've always been a huge fan with Travis there. But again, you've got to – the goaltending issue seems to be solved, but it's now – I look at just teams across – and, you know, there's some teams that we're going to get to. There's guys that you just know that you're comfortable with that position, and still there's teams you're hoping you are. Mm-hmm. And I think now – Ottawa should be comfortable now at that position, whereas some other teams I think are still hoping.
They just got to make a leap, the Sens. Like, they just haven't. Well, it's been too long.
I mean, it's the same thing. Ottawa, and that's the thing. I think Ottawa, though, you can see these signs of making it. I mean, a little bit of a head scratcher how short period of time I thought Chikrin was going to be a piece there for him to be moved on from. But, you know, they got something for him. But I just don't get they're making progress in my mind. Whereas Montreal's going much slower than I anticipated. And Buffalo, who I just love some of the pieces, but it's like, that's the biggest stationary bike race in NHL history. Like, I just don't see them having improved one iota in a great hockey city. So,
yeah. Well, one of the teams that did make that leap last year was the Vancouver Canucks. I think they surprised a lot of people in the first full year under Rick Tocchet. And, you know, they've made some some ads. Jake DeBrusk is there now, and you know, but they've also lost some pieces. Lindholm's gone, Zadorov's gone. So they might have been a year early, but is this just a situation of like, well, it kind of hinges on the health of Thatcher Demko long term, where like
100%. I mean, I love that. And I don't know what school you guys went to. You guys must have a different alphabet than me. So we're on the fifth team and we're at the V's.
So, anyway. Rubinov's jumping around, yeah. I promise.
Yeah,
I'm looking for links to just go from place to place.
I looked at that last year. You think the strides they made and the pieces that they have, and if they have a healthy Demko, what that playoff run could have been like. I still think, I mean, I loved where I think Edmonton's A game is still better than their A game, but it's almost in a situation like the Leafs. When you go an entire season and then that first playoff game, you know, you dress rehearsal all year and then all of a sudden your first playoff game, you're missing Nylander and then you're missing Matthews. As much as I hate the fact they went out in the first round, you can't. This is, you work a whole year. So as Vancouver works this whole year and puts this wonderful picture together, and then their best player, most important position, is nowhere to be seen. It's just, it's a tough evaluation. I just think now they're used to talk, the expectations, they expect to win. I love the fact that they locked up Hronek to be with Hughes. That's an important thing. And DeBrusk is a huge add. Huge loss in Zadorov for me. He brought a physical presence. I drafted Derek Forbert. And as much as I love Forbes, he's injury prone because of how hard he plays. But if Zadorov is a 5 on the grit meter, Derek is not. So there's a lot of grit on the back end that's being lost in Zadorov, and Heinen's a nice piece, but it'll be interesting. I think it's going to be between them and Edmonton fighting for the top of that division. And then again, I look at Vegas has lost a lot, but I see them in the 3-hole, and then I see some teams like it's probably the only division that you can look at and say two teams are already out of it in the summer, and that's Anaheim and San Jose. So they've got to find a way to, you know, build off what they did last year. But I love the direction they're heading, and I think DeBrusk is going to be a nice piece. Still think the Zadorov grid in the back end is going to haunt them a little bit, but I love the direction they're heading.
We'll go back to E, Jesse, the Edmonton Oilers. This was an impressive offseason. I mean, Jeff Jackson knew at the job, clearly. Maybe he doesn't need to hire a general manager. Maybe he does. But they're suddenly a destination, and that's a lot of Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl and what they did last year. But I can't believe that they didn't suffer the cost of winning without winning. The Oilers, are they far and away the most prepared at this moment to go to a Stanley Cup final and potentially win it?
I think so. And if I was Jeff too, it's what a great time to get out, right? Run away from that general manager. Everything he has absolutely touched has turned to gold since they left the ice. And magical. I mean, his staff obviously support staff. But when you think, you know, if Skinner's learned from this and that's what you're getting out of him, that he's, you know, you're getting that. He's probably now training to a guy that, you know, that position solidified. And then you come out of that and you add, I think, one of the biggest adds, and he must be just sitting at home just, you know, every night just, you know, having the best time of his life is Skinner, because I mean, this is a guy, I know it's the worst thing you can have, but you know what, you know that this guy's going to break his streak of 1,000 games without a playoff. And now he's coming to the Edmonton Oilers. Now, if that streak is still alive at the end of the year, they should float him off to sea at some point.
Something's wrong. Something would be wrong.
He is a talented, talented player, above character. Connor Brown last year probably took a little bit more money, and it's such a class act to get. If you get the playoff version of Connor Brown for $1 million, that's unbelievable. And then you kind of now start to see guys taking less. Like Henrik had more on the table. He comes back, and these guys can smell it. I still think structurally, me and Yarmark too is huge. You lose McLeod. That doesn't bother me a bit. I think the biggest decision for them now is, and again, I love Darnell Nurse as a player. I think he's overpaid. But now you've got Bouchard coming up. So you've got a guy, clearly, the agency business, they look and say, okay, Bouchard's their number one D, so he's got to make more than Nurse. They've got to find a way to make a happy medium and get these guys under. I don't think there's going to be any problem trying signing Draisaitl back, and I don't think there's going to be any problem signing McDavid back. But I think the Bouchard one's going to take some massaging because of the Nurse contract. And on top of that, they add this, I don't know how to pronounce, they get Buffalo's, one of Buffalo's top prospects. I mean, so you're quietly even adding to your prospect pool while you're getting the current product better. I guess the one I have is the Evander Kane issue. They only know internally, I mean, obviously this guy, for me, as much as there's always seems to be another story that has got some cloud over it, he's a unicorn when it comes to what he brings as a player when he's focused. And if they can get that playing its A game healthy or decide to move on from that and build on their back end, he still has incredible value. And teams, everybody's always going to think they can get to him from a personality standpoint, where what have you. But he is something they desperately need with the protection fact. But undeniably, sometimes you want a player like that to be more protective of his teammates, and Vander seems a little bit more protective of himself at times. That being said, he's too good a hockey player, but he could be a huge asset if you want to get a little bit better on the back end.
Okay, so we could have gone alphabetical. I abandoned that. Could have gone east-west. Not for me. Could have gone west to east. I didn't do that either. So now there's two left. It's dealer's choice.
When Elise is here, we have none of these alphabet problems. Yeah.
so it's dealer's choice. You can go Jets or Maple Leafs, whichever one you want.
We got 4 minutes, Mike. So let's talk Toronto.
Yeah.
Just a general reaction to what they did this offseason.
I like it. I mean, they're taking a lot of heat, I think, because they said, you know, everything's on the table. And I think everybody that said we're going to address the core, right? The core four or how have you. But I love the Tanev signing, a little bit longer deal, but I think that'll work itself out in the end. He's exactly what they need in the back end. You hope he remains healthy. I love Ekman Larson's a different player when he's, I didn't like that. Larson was almost like you get on him because, again, the contract was way too high. And his ice time was way too high in Vancouver, but I love the version that was in Florida. And I think now he's a Stanley Cup champion. That's going to help. I love the dime. I thought Domi was great in the playoffs. He's born to be a Toronto player. It's a great signing. Robertson clearly hasn't worked out. I guess it's, again, I think Hakanpaa is a nice add on depth. And right, there's more right side. Their defense looks a little bit better when you add it up. I think people forget, again, in the playoffs that McCann, this guy was having an unbelievable year, man, and he's missing. So there's found money there. A lot of people forget how Benoit was coming along and the huge, you know, how he was moving forward. I think you're going to get a much better version of Morgan Rielly with Tanev on his side. Again, I go to the teams at a very, very important position. And I know how much Brad, and it's unfortunate it was the Calgary Flames he's dealing with, because that's like doing a, for Brad, that would be the equivalent of doing a 100-yard dash in a 90-yard gym trying to get a play trade done with the Calgary Flames. But I know how much they wanted Markstrom, and they weren't going to be dealing with them. So I guess that position now, if it lives up to what you want, stays healthy, I mean, you're comfortable with what you've seen at a wall, and you hope that, you know, Stolarz is a Stanley Cup champion too. But again, you're hoping at that position you're going to get out of it. Whereas, and again, it's some of it's health related, but it's such an important position that there still is that element of hope at a very key position, and hopefully they prove themselves. But I think that's when, you know, and as a fan, you got to be careful. And obviously I haven't talked about Mitch Marner, but you got to be careful too, because you got a player like Easton Cowan that wins the player of the year. And as a Leaf fan, you're like, get him in there. You know, he's going to be a star. Well, Easton Cowan off ice looks about 147 pounds, right? So you don't want to rush somebody who's physically not ready for the National Hockey League and maybe have them break in half. So they got to be a little patient with somebody because they have something there, but he's got to get a lot stronger. And again, Mitch Marner's a superstar. Whatever's going on, it seems like everything he does now, people are all over him. Some of it's self-inflicted wounds, but only internally they know what they're going to do there. Obviously, if there's a deal to be made, he's got a huge asset. I always have thought if there's a move to be made that the Vegas Golden Knights were a team that I think there's something there that can really benefit both teams. But if he has to come back and play, this is a proud Toronto kid that puts up huge numbers, and who knows, maybe with Tavares coming off the books next year, they can afford to keep Mitch around. But they've got to do something about it, because it's just such a sore talking point that even when you're having even when there's positive things to talk about, it always comes back to what's going on with Mitch, or Mitch this, Mitch that. And you can't detract from the fact that this guy is, I think he might be the fourth leading scorer in the history of the Leafs. And yeah, we want him to be better in the playoffs, but you can't convince me and again, I hate excuses being a Toronto fan, and they've got way too many of them, but you can't convince me that if Nylander and Matthews were healthy, that there wasn't a chance that was going their way in the first round of the playoffs. But when you've got such a horrid, you know, past history of failures, those things get overlooked because nobody wants to hear excuses, but those are pretty darn good ones.
Mike, we're up against it. We got to do 15 minutes on the Winnipeg Jets next time because we didn't get to them. But this is the end of the fan pregame.
We could just say Toffoli's left and Monahan's left and Dylan left and wow.
Okay, that's it. That's all we need. That's Mike Buda. This has been the Fan Pregame. Jesse, we'll be back.
Thanks, buddy.
See ya.